Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Liver Cancer Treatment Update and Managing the Costs of Treatment. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer-related organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and all of your interest that we have so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 373 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the United States, and we have international participants from Canada, Germany, and the United Kingdom. So you really, it's a bit of a global call, people from all over the world to some extent. Now, today's program is made possible by Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about Cancer Care, about our services, about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing, about all of the different collaborating organizations as additional resources for all of you. And there also is an evaluation form. And I want to ask you all to complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us what programs you'd like us to offer going forward? And we are planning many programs going forward, both in terms of actually we're approaching 2014, and we have many more programs that we're planning. So we're very eager to hear your recommendations. Indeed, this program today is one that many have asked us to do, and we were able to provide it. So we try very hard to listen to your recommendations and to offer the programs that you suggest. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. David Ryan. And Dr. Ryan is Chief Division of Hematology Oncology, Clinical Director, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, Director, Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ryan is going to address an overview of liver cancer, current standard of care, and controlling symptoms and pain. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Ryan.
Carolyn, thanks so much for having me today. So at the outset, let me first describe a common misperception and what we're referring to today as liver cancer. There are three types of cancers in general that arise in the liver. The first type and most common is the type of cancer that spreads from someplace else, whether it be the colon, the lung, breast, and we're not talking about that type of cancer today. That's called metastatic cancer in the liver. The second type of cancer that arises in the liver is a cancer that arises from the bile ducts, often called a cholangiocarcinoma or a bile duct cancer, and we're not talking about that cancer today. What we are talking about is the type of cancer that arises in the cells, the primary cells of the liver, and that type of cancer is called a hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC for short, or for the rest of this program, we're going to refer to it as primary liver cancer. So primary liver cancer typically develops, not always, but typically develops in the setting of chronic liver injury, and that chronic liver injury in the United States is most commonly due to either hepatitis, chronic hepatitis, that can either be hepatitis B or hepatitis C, or can be due to cirrhosis from excessive alcohol use. Those would be the two most common forms of liver injury that lead to the development of primary liver cancer, but not always. Sometimes we see primary liver cancer arise in a setting where somebody didn't have any pre-existing liver injury. And whenever we meet somebody for the first time with a primary liver cancer, we embark on a series of studies called staging, where we want to find out exactly how extensive the tumor is in the liver and throughout the body. And typically we'll go ahead and order two types of imaging tests. We'll order a liver MRI to assess the extent of cancer within the liver. An MRI is probably the best test for looking specifically at the liver. And then the second test we'll order is typically a chest, abdomen, and pelvic CT or CAT scan. And a CT scan allows us to see if the cancer has spread any place outside of the liver. And so whenever we meet somebody with a primary liver cancer, the first question we ask is this tumor contained to the liver? Is it isolated to the liver, or has it spread to some other site, meaning the lungs, the lymph nodes, or someplace else in the abdomen? And the reason we ask that question is we're always looking to cure people first, and the only way to cure liver cancer is to mechanically resect all of the tumor tissue. So the first thing we're looking to do is see if the tumor is localized to the liver. And if it is, there are two main ways that we try and cure somebody of liver cancer. The first is we look and see if we can surgically resect the cancer itself. So if somebody has an isolated liver nodule or an isolated area of the liver that's involved, a liver surgeon can go in and cut out or resect that primary liver cancer, and people can be cured. However, because many of these cancers arise in the setting of chronic liver injury, it's often either not safe to resect a certain amount of liver because there's not enough liver to sustain life that's going to be left behind, or the tumor is what we call multifocal. It already has several nodules within the liver. In that case, we often look to see if somebody might be a candidate for liver transplantation. Now, that makes people very confused. Why can't they transplant my liver is often a question we get. Well, liver transplantation in this setting is going to accomplish two purposes. The first purpose is to get out all of the cancer, and the second purpose is to give somebody a new liver because most of these cancers arise in the setting of chronic liver injury. And so if we can transplant the liver, often we can cure patients who have primary liver cancer. If the situation is that we either can't surgically resect the primary liver cancer or somebody's not a candidate for liver transplantation, there are a number of surgical substitutes that we'll try and use, all of which attempt to mechanically remove tumor tissue. And you've probably heard of some of these ways that we try and accomplish this. One way is called RFA, which stands for radio frequency ablation. It's almost like getting a liver biopsy. The interventional radiologists or the surgeons numb up an area on the surface of your skin and then, usually under CT scan guidance, put a probe directly into the cancer and, with the help of radio frequency waves, ablate all of that area around the cancer and hopefully all of the cancer cells themselves. Other modalities include cryotherapy or cryoablation, and then an increasingly popular form of treatment is standard radiation therapy. The radiation oncologists have become quite skilled at delivering very focal radiation to specific areas where the cancer is involved. You can imagine that in the old days, this was very hard because as people were breathing, the livers would move up and down on the basis of the diaphragm moving. Nowadays, they have tools that can, what we call, gate the breathing and allow people to deliver high doses of radiation specifically to those areas where the cancer is involved. But sometimes, even those modalities aren't effective because the tumor has spread throughout the liver in such a pattern that we can't do those surgical substitutes. And so then often we try a treatment modality that we refer to as TACE, T-A-C-E, which stands for transarterial chemoembolization. And the interventional radiologist will inject chemotherapy directly into the liver in an attempt to kill those cancer cells and hold them steady for as long as we possibly can. Often people will undergo repeated attempts at this TACE or transarterial chemoembolization in an attempt to keep the cancer under control. But sometimes we pick up other areas of cancer. So let's say the CT scan showed that the cancer may be spread outside of the liver. And if it spread to the lymph nodes or to some other place in the abdomen or lungs or even bones, we will then turn to medical therapy to keep this cancer under control. And there are two main types of medical therapies that we use. The first type we use is a targeted agent against the what's called the VEGF, V-E-G-F, or vascular endothelial growth factor pathway. That's typically a drug called sorafenib. Sorafenib is an oral drug that we use to keep this cancer under control for many months on end, where people take this medication. It's generally well tolerated. It has several side effects. Notably, it can make people a little bit tired, and it can cause something called hand-foot syndrome. I like to describe this as people getting a sunburn on the palms of their hands or the soles of their feet. Their hands and feet get red and peely and scaly, and that's called hand-foot syndrome. These would be the two most common side effects that people can experience. Often with some reducing the dosage of the medication, we can get those side effects under control. The second major type of medical therapy that we do for people with primary liver cancer is chemotherapy. And most of the time, we use a regimen that is often used in other gastrointestinal cancers called FOLFOX. FOLFOX is a European acronym, F-O-L-F-O-X. It makes no sense in English, but everybody uses this acronym anyway. And it basically stands for 5-fluorouracil and oxaliplatin and a B vitamin called leucovorin. And when people use the acronym FOLFOX, they're also referring to the schedule that this chemotherapy is delivered. And it's an interesting schedule. People usually come into the chemotherapy infusion unit, wherever you might be, and for roughly half a day, you're in the chemotherapy infusion unit getting all three of these drugs, 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil, which we usually call shorten to 5-FU, oxaliplatin, and then the B vitamin leucovorin. And at the end of that half a day, you actually then get hooked up to a pump that goes in over 46 hours. So most of the people who get this regimen will require a portacath, and that's a venous access device that goes in under the skin, under the collarbone. And this regimen is given for these over this 46 hours every other week. It's a very common regimen that we use throughout the GI cancer program for colon cancer, stomach cancer, nowadays pancreatic cancer, and even primary liver cancer. The major side effects of this regimen are numbness and tingling in the hands and feet. Usually it's a very strange numbness and tingling that comes on when people are exposed to cold in the very beginning. Your hands will get cold when you reach into the fridge for the first 48 hours or so. Or if you drink something cold, your mouth will get all numb and tingly for a couple of seconds. And this cold-induced neuropathy lasts for about 2 days after each treatment. But often it becomes dose-limiting. So when people respond very well to this FOLFOX regimen, numbness and tingling almost always develops by 4 to 6 months after treatment. The other major side effect is a little bit of nausea, which is very well controlled with anti-nausea medication, and occasionally a little bit of diarrhea, which also is very well controlled with diarrhea medication. We use all of these different therapies, surgery, surgical substitutes, TACE, and medical therapy to give people the best chances at the best case scenario. And that's the general overview of primary liver cancer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ryan. That's an excellent overview and really an outstanding presentation. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Ahmed Kaseb. Dr. Kaseb is Associate Professor and Director, Hepatocellular Carcinoma Program, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Kaseb is going to address new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. Dr. Kaseb?
Thank you, Carolyn, and I think Dr. Ryan really did a great job here. My job is much, much easier now after he laid the ground with explaining in details and yet, you know, very clear words that are easy to understand to all of our patients and families on the phone. So now let me start by alluding to new treatment approaches in the treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma. So the first treatment approach that I'd like to discuss is related to the surgical treatment modality. So as Dr. Ryan exactly said, surgery is the only chance for cure from liver cancer. So that's always the first question that we get asked in clinic by all patients. Can you cut it out? Can you give me a new liver? So in terms of new approaches in this area, there is something which what we call portal vein embolization. So basically, when somebody has got a liver tumor that is not resectable upfront, and yet they have good liver function, the liver injury is not very advanced, and there may be a room for surgery if the tumor is a little bit smaller, or if the healthy liver part a little bit bigger. So we try to do this artificially. So how do we do this? We really focus on, as Dr. Ryan said, the embolization of the artery supplying the tumor, meaning that we go ahead and cut the blood supply to the tumor to shrink it a little bit, which is an established method, and it's called TACE, transarterial chemoembolization. And then a month later, in average, we try to go back in and block the vein of the same side of that liver lobe, and that way we divert the blood supply to the other lobe of the liver to make it bigger. So that way the patient will have enough liver tissue, and that will make it amenable for the patient to survive after a big liver surgery like this. So these are the cases where, you know, the tumor is big and the remaining liver tissue is critical. So that's why we try to shrink the tumor, and in the meantime, try to induce some enlargement of the remaining liver tissue by diverting the blood supply from the unhealthy liver to the healthy liver. So that would be a month later, we get another scan, and if we see more than 20% increase in the size of the uninvolved lobe, then we go ahead and do the surgery. And these are the cases where we have big tumor sitting in the right side of the liver, where we have to take the whole right lobe out. So this is the first approach. It's been used for the last few years. It's called portal vein embolization, or PVE. And the second new treatment approach that I'd like to allude to is related to the same modality, which is intra-arterial treatment approaches. Dr. Ryan did a beautiful job explaining how we do these things. It's basically like having a heart cath, and then the catheter goes up to the liver instead of the heart, through from the groin up to the hepatic artery, the artery that is supplying the tumor, and then we inject either chemotherapy or radiation beads. So the new treatment approaches here are really focusing on introducing new chemotherapy spheres, basically drug-eluting or slow-release kind of chemotherapy drugs. So that way, instead of the old methodology, which involved injecting the chemotherapy and patient would get a high peak within the liver itself where they can get a lot of pain and liver function may go up abruptly, the new technique would enable us to infuse drug-eluting beads or slow-release spheres, which patients tolerate much better, and it could also affect the tumor for a longer period of time. So this is called drug-eluting beads, or DEB. And then another modality that we use using the same kind of catheter approach is yttrium-90 spheres, which is radiation spheres. So this is also very peculiar to the liver. It's been used in the last few years. We call it Y90 for some patients who like to search that on the internet, or yttrium-90. So basically the same idea of going through the artery, supplying the tumor itself, and then injecting the radiation spheres inside the liver, because the normal liver tissue could handle higher doses of radiation spheres this way. So this is in terms of the intra-arterial catheter approach. And then we go down the list to include the radiation. Dr. Ryan talked about the radiation treatment, and that's from outside the body, not through the artery supplying the tumor. So there is also some new approaches and modalities like the proton therapy, which is high doses of radiation. Some patients also have heard about stereotactic radiation, which is also high doses of radiation given at a shorter interval rather than doing it over longer standardized radiation protocols. So these two modalities are also new in the last 5 to 10 years, and they are always limited to patients with good liver functions who could handle this high dose of radiation. Most of the time it's one tumor or two tumors close to each other with enough liver tissue for the patient to be able to survive on. So that's in terms of local therapy approaches for patients who have tumors limited to their liver. So in terms of other new approaches for drugs to be given by mouth or IV, this will take us to the second topic of my talk here, which is the role of the clinical trials. So in 2005, 2006, there was only like 30 clinical trials worldwide, if you go to clinicaltrials.gov. Nowadays, if you go to clinicaltrials.gov, you see over 300 studies listed there, which is either systemic therapy only, which is either oral drugs or IV drugs, or a combination of systemic therapy and localized therapy that we just mentioned, either drug-eluting beads or yttrium-90 or ablation techniques. So there is hundreds of studies being conducted globally as we speak, addressing all settings of hepatocellular carcinoma, whether we want to shrink the tumor down to be able to offer surgery or transplant, or we're trying to slow down the tumors for those patients who cannot go for surgery or transplant, or just to manage symptoms, try to decrease the size of the tumor so the patient would have a better quality of life, pain control, and so on. So there is a lot of drugs now in clinical trials. Only one of them is approved, which is Nexavar, as Dr. Ryan alluded to, which is not a chemotherapy drug, but it's a biologic therapy. It works by cutting the blood supply to the tumor and so on, as Dr. Ryan explained. So it's only one drug that has been approved by the FDA in 2007, and since then we've been searching for another approach through the clinical trials. So in a nutshell, we can say that there is a big role for the clinical trials in hepatocellular carcinoma, no matter what setting, whether the patient is a candidate for local therapies or just for systemic therapies, or even a potential candidate for surgery. So I would always encourage our patients to entertain this option whenever available. Third topic in my talk is really tapping into a very, very relevant area to patients and their families, which is communicating with your healthcare team about your quality of life concerns. So Dr. Ryan talked about, you know, the toxicity of some of the systemic therapy that we give to our patients. Unfortunately, most of the patients get it sooner or later if they never make it to surgery. So it's really a big concern to patients and their families to watch their beloved family member going through some side effects related to the treatment. And it's very critical for them to be able to communicate that with their healthcare team. So I always encourage my patients to call me or email, or you know, any form of communication they feel comfortable with. Patients sometimes feel like they really have to just be tough and take it, and they think that they have to be on those high doses to have the effect, but it's actually not true, because some patients could have the same kind of efficacy at a lower doses of the drugs. So that's why we always tell our patients to communicate that with us, so we can work with them to decrease the doses of the drugs, maybe the frequency with some interruptions sometimes and so on, for them to handle it better, and hopefully it will have the same efficacy. So this is very, very critical. That's why it's a multidisciplinary approach here that would have to involve a dietitian, would have to involve symptom management team, or what we call supportive care team, physical therapist as well, home health care to address our patients' needs at home. So it's really a multidisciplinary kind of care that starts from clinic and always gets triggered by patients' needs and family members' questions and concerns. So this is very, very critical for our patients and family and families to communicate with us at their clinical care team. I'll stop here, and I'll let our speakers take it from here, and I'll be looking forward to answering questions from our patients and families.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Kassab. That was a wonderful presentation, and particularly highlighting a number of different issues, but and ending with the concept of the importance of communicating or talking with the healthcare team and that whole team working together. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Diana Bearden is a supervisor of clinical nutrition. She's a dietitian, a licensed dietitian, and she's with the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address your nutritional concerns and tips, and it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation, addressing nutritional concerns in the presence of liver cancer. My goal is to discuss tips for managing side effects that can impact your nutrition, side effects that you may experience during treatment. For your cancer. Eating well during your treatment can provide you energy to do the things you enjoy, as well as maintaining your weight and your muscle mass. Patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery from side effects. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, and it can cause breaks in treatment, as well as slow the healing process. By meeting your nutritional goals during your treatment, maintaining your weight, preserving your lean muscle mass, these are all components in accomplishing that we want to accomplish with meeting your nutritional needs. Some common side effects patients experience during treatment are nausea, vomiting, sometimes decrease in appetite, oftentimes bowel function, either diarrhea or constipation. Taste changes may be experienced as well. Fatigue is a common side effect I hear from patients a lot, and these all compose barriers to a patient meeting their nutritional needs. So just to address each one of them with you all and give you some tips to finding ways to incorporate different foods into your diet that you can tolerate to help maintain your nutritional status. So if you're experiencing nausea and vomiting or have a poor appetite, some ways to address this can be eliminating offending odors. Warm foods carry more odors than cold foods do. So if things are triggered, such as by smell, you know, going to colder foods it can be an option to help manage that. And if you're feeling nauseated, a lot of times that can be from the medications, and the medical teams really know this is going to happen. So they'll tell you, you know, you'll experience this side effect. It's very common on such and such day, and they'll plan with medications to help reduce some of that. But nausea can also happen if you're not eating enough throughout the day. If you're going on an empty stomach and taking medications, that can a lot of times aggravate it. So always having something with you, dry crackers, toast, can help just keep something on your stomach. Also avoiding overly sweetened foods and foods that are fried or greasy or highly seasoned. These types of foods can cause GI upset as well, and a lot of times it can be confusing because if you're experiencing weight loss, eating high-calorie foods makes sense, but sometimes these high-calorie foods can have uncomfortable side effects. So talking with your healthcare team is important in identifying the best types of foods for you to try. To address the issue of a poor appetite, focusing on small, frequent meals is something we suggest often. We want to have those meals consist of high-calorie and high-protein foods. And finding a time to eat when you're not under stress, you know, especially when you're going through treatment, it's very stressful. You're rushing from an appointment to an appointment. Like it was said earlier, sometimes you're in treatments for a good chunk of the day. So planning ahead and having foods with you to eat during the times when you're not rushing can be optimal to improve your digestion. Exercising as tolerated is also very helpful. Just getting a little bit of activity can help stimulate your appetite and improve digestion as well. But talk with your doctor about what type of physical activity is appropriate for you. Taste change is another another side effect patients experience, and keeping good oral hygiene is important. That will help a lot of patients just reset their taste buds. Rinsing your mouth with water and a little bit of baking soda before eating can cleanse your palate. But taste changes can be very specific. You may have a taste in your mouth, and there are suggestions for. A lot of times patients have a taste of metal, or they have everything taste like cardboard. Things may taste too sweet or too salty. So talking with your healthcare team, that can be a good way to dialogue about foods to try to help offset some of those taste changes. If you're experiencing any mouth sores or anything that's causing sensitivity with your eating, choosing soft, moist foods that are easy to chew and swallow, avoiding things that are rough in texture or acidic. Those can aggravate anything if you're having any activity go on in your mouth as far as sores. Tart and spicy foods, eliminate those as well. They can cause more irritation. Trying drinks or supplement drinks are an option to help increase your calorie intake. So you may find that mixing up some of those may be an option as well if you're having sensitivity in your mouth. A change in bowel function is also a side effect that patients experience at times. And depending on the cause of diarrhea or constipation, it will depend on how it's addressed. So like I said earlier, a lot of times with your treatment, the doctors and medical team know that certain side effects are common with certain treatment, and a lot of times they will give medication to help offset some of those. But there are some things you can do with your diet as well. And so if you're experiencing constipation, it may be from pain medications or decrease in activity. A lot of times dehydration can be one of the struggles someone's going through, and that can also contribute to constipation. If you're experiencing diarrhea, it may mean that we need to look at the fiber content in your diet and the types of foods that you're eating, but staying hydrated to help meet your fluid needs is important also. And lastly, I'd just like to touch on fatigue. Getting enough fluid and meeting your nutritional needs are a big component in helping to address the symptoms of fatigue. And communicate with your healthcare team to arrange a time to meet to talk about, you know, am I getting enough nutrition and is this an impact on how I'm feeling so that we can help work together and nip these issues in the bud before they go on for too long. So I hope this has been helpful, and this concludes my thoughts. I'm going to hand it back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Barrett, for just an excellent presentation. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you in terms of what to eat and what to do. Thank you so much during the Q&A. Thanks. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. Elizabeth is an oncology social worker, and she's program coordinator here at Cancer Care. And she's going to address the practical worries about costs of cancer, the services you can access from cancer care, sources of financial assistance, and what are patient assistance programs and copay foundations. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Liz Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. So again, my name is Elizabeth Ezra, and I am an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I'll be speaking about a major concern for people with cancer. How am I going to pay for my care? Cancer is an expensive illness, and financial concerns are understandable, as well as a significant source of stress. However, having an open conversation about the cost of cancer can help you become better informed about your options, and you may be able to reduce the financial impact of your illness and hopefully the stress. When it comes to managing medical expenses, it pays to be informed and upfront. Number one, understand your insurance policy so you are not blindsided by charges, and ask your insurance company to assign you a case manager. Number two, keep a diary of your expenses. This will enable you to catch any billing errors. And I have to say there are many billing errors in our system. Number three, talk to your healthcare team as soon as possible about your financial situation. The 2009 ASCO publication on the cost of cancer made speaking to your oncologist about financial concerns no longer a taboo subject. And it is important not to delay in applying for benefits as it takes so much time for them to be processed. If medical bills threaten to overwhelm you, the experts recommend that you speak up immediately, as many settings, one, may offer a payment plan, two, reduce some charges, and three, have special funding. Do not ignore the bills, for once they go to collections, they are much harder to resolve. This sounds like a tall order, especially when you are not feeling well, but there are organizations that can help, or at least help direct you to resources for help. Organizations like Cancer Care, the Chronic Disease Fund, Cancer Financial Assistance Coalition, and the American Cancer Society. Some numbers are in your packages, and some will give you at the end of the call. Many maintain a state-by-state resource database, so you can search specifically by your own zip code. The Patient Advocate Foundation provides case management and advocacy to help negotiate financial matters, and a patient can also ask to speak to a medical billing specialist to help decipher the bills. There are programs to assist patients with their medications, such as free drug programs for people with no insurance, copay programs for specific medications, drug copayment assistance program for people with private insurance, and disease-specific copayment assistance program. All of these are administered by non-profit Foundation. The Chronic Disease Fund helps people diagnosed with liver cancer, and I'd like to give you their number now. Carolyn will also give it to you at the end. Their number is 877-968-7233. Again, 877-968-7233. They're also on the web at cdfund.org. How do I find these local programs? The United Way has a 211 referral number for organizations in your area. You can go to 211.org and put in your zip code for local resources. I recommend this to people across the nation all the time. Cancer Care, Patient Advocate Foundation, and ACS, American Cancer Society, also provide listings for local resources. You may also be able to find help with transportation expenses, lodging, and medical expenses if you contact these organizations. In conclusion, get informed, speak up, get organized, and ask for help. Oh. Remember, I just want to say one thing about cancer care services before we go, okay, Carolyn?
Absolutely.
Remember, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situations and have similar concerns. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a general support group over the phone for both the patients and caregivers, as well as an online group for caregivers. We also have unique young adult caregiver groups as well. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care's services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. It's wonderful and very comprehensive, a lot of different topics and things that are very close to the heart for everybody on the call, so thank you. And our next speaker is Deborah Wolf, and Deborah Wolf is an attorney. She's Senior Attorney, Legal Health, New York Legal Assistance Group, or NILAG. And Ms. Wolf is going to address tips on appealing medical insurance claims, entitlement programs, and provider denials. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Carolyn. And I'm happy to be a part of this teleconference today. And as Carolyn said, I'll be discussing tips on appealing insurance denials. There are some changes with the Affordable Care Act as of January 2014, and I'll mention some of these as well. As a start, it's important to know that there are different types of insurance policies, and these include group policies from employment, union benefits, and privately purchased policies. I'll also briefly discuss Medicaid and Medicare. Insurance appeal rules vary depending on the type of policy or plan you have. Also, state insurance laws may apply, so your rights might vary depending on where you live. As such, this will be very general advice relating to all. I want to first take a minute to discuss some steps you can take to avoid claim denials. First, have and read a copy of your policy or a summary description of your policy, and this will outline your benefits, the appeals process, and any coverage limits. With the Affordable Care Act, there are no more monetary caps on benefits or pre-existing condition exclusions on many plans, but there may be other limitations. Next, if your policy requires pre-authorization, then most do for major medical procedures and radiology, such as PET scans and MRIs, make sure you check to make sure the procedure has been approved before undergoing the procedure. Your insurance company is required to provide an explanation of benefit called an EOB for each claim they've reviewed. The EOB outlines the amount paid, your required contribution, which can be your copay or a percentage, and if they're not paying and denying the claim, the reasons for the denial. It's important to read every explanation of benefit to make sure your claim has been fully paid, and if not, the reasons for the denial. For example, with denials for failure to obtain pre-authorization, call your insurance company and ask what they need to improve the claim, because they often will work with you to give retroactive recertification of the claim. If the insurance company denies for lack of medical necessity, they will often allow you or your doctor to submit further documents to support the necessity. Claims are also sometimes denied for administrative reasons that are easy to fix. For example, the medical provider wrote the wrong code or incorrect policy number. As Elizabeth Ezra mentioned, there can be billing errors as well. So call your insurance company first, see if they can help you resolve it, and make sure to keep track of every call or letter, writing down the date and who you spoke to. If the matter can't be resolved by speaking with the insurance company, you have the right to file an appeal directly to your insurer, and this is called an administrative appeal. with the Affordable Care Act, health plans and insurance companies have to tell you why they've decided to deny a claim with very specific information. You also have the right to request a full copy of your insurance file prior to the appeal to see how they reached their decision to deny and what documents they used to base the denial. In your appeal, document the reasons you disagree with the insurance company and include medical exhibits and a letter from your treating doctor. I often ask the treating doctor to review the denial letter and to write a response as well to be submitted with the appeal. Your insurance company must conduct a full and fair review of its decision, and if the case is urgent, your insurance company must expedite this process. If your insurance company denies the appeal, you then have the right to request an external review, which gives you the right to file an appeal to an outside, objective, and independent panel, no matter where you live and what type of insurance you have. This is one of the changes coming with the Affordable Care Act. This means that independent medical professionals with no financial stake in the claim make the decision. If the external reviewer overturns your insurance company denial, your insurer must give you the payments or services you requested in the claim. Another important Affordable Care Act protection will be an expanded state Office of Consumer Assistance that will respond to inquiries and complaints by consumer, but also help file complaints and appeals, and this will be available in every state. Finally, it's very important to make sure you understand your time limits to file the appeal, as these are very strict deadlines. If you have a policy from employment, the time limit is 180 days from the date you receive the denial. For other plans, the deadline will be set forth in the policy. But remember that an insurance policy is a contract, meaning you must adhere to the rules laid out in the contract. The good news is that more than half of all denied claims that are appealed to the top are finally allowed coverage. The percentage for external reviews to a state insurance department is even higher. If you draw on all the resources available to you and you have adequate medical support for your claim, you stand a very good chance of having your claim paid after an initial denial. Now, Medicaid and Medicare are both governed by federal or state law, but you are also entitled to an appeal or a fair hearing if your claim is denied. If a claim is denied, you will receive written notice about how to appeal, but you generally have to file your appeal within 60 days after the date of the denial notice. But just make sure to read the notice and follow any of the rules set forth. When appealed, even a higher percentage of these Medicaid and Medicare cases are reversed. Understanding your rights and responsibilities regarding insurance appeals is important. To summarize, it's important to read your health care policy so that you understand your coverage, what is required of you, how to appeal, and any deadlines that are imposed. Appeal deadlines are strict, so make sure to read your explanation of benefits from the insurance company and respond on time. I know it's difficult to keep on top of insurance matters with so much else going on, but with a better understanding, as well as help from the Consumer Assistance Program, you'll be able to navigate insurance issues or questions that come up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wolf. That was a very comprehensive and really excellent overview of the appeals process and really an encouragement to people to appeal because there's a lot on their side in terms of when you appeal that you often have a very good chance of overturning the denial. So excellent. Okay, well, now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board now, and I'm going to ask Kate to explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get to your question, you know you can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll give you that number again toward the end of the call, but at this point, let's see how many questions we can take right now. So, Kate, if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
So I have a question from one of our online participants, from Susan. It's a question for Dr. Ryan. What is the name of the VEGF drug? Please spell, what if a portacath cannot be used for therapy? Dr. Ryan, could you address this question?
Yeah, so the name of the drug is called sorafenib, S-O-R-A-F-E-N-I-B. The other name is Nexavar, so same one. Sorafenib is the generic name, and Nexavar is the drug name. And you don't need a portacath. It's oral. You only need a portacath for the chemotherapy regimen that we use that I refer to as FOLFOX.
Excellent. Do you want to say a bit about the oral medications and what they often mean for people to be able to take a pill as opposed to coming in and having a portacath?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm a big fan, though, of telling people that just because it's a pill doesn't mean it's going to be any easier on you. And in fact, sometimes I like when I have the choice of giving either a pill or an IV medication, say they're equivalent, I'll often pick the IV because you get the whole cancer center program, including a nurse who independently assesses you and helps you out. And so just because something is given orally doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have an easier time with it or have less side effects. The other problem we have with oral medication is people often forget to take their medication and then will do things like double up the dose, which is terrible. Never double up the dose. Or, you know, they'll skip an entire couple of days and forget about it and not even tell their doctors because they're embarrassed about it. Whereas when you give something intravenously, you know it's been given. Having said that, oral medications definitely are more convenient if you get the same amount of side effects or less side effects. They're definitely more convenient because you don't have to have a portacath. You don't have to drive yourself into the infusion unit or into clinic at a regular interval, and that you can follow up with your physician on a time and place that's more convenient for you. So from that perspective, it's definitely more convenient. But don't ever make the mistake of thinking that it's going to be safer because it's oral. A drug is a drug.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. And we have another question from one of our online participants. And the question is, can hepatocellular carcinoma have been caused by non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? Would chemotherapy treatment for NHL, bendamustine, and rituximab have any effect on liver cancer? Dr. Kassab, would you like to address that question?
Yeah, so the question is regarding chemotherapy-induced secondary cancers. So it's not known really for hepatocellular carcinoma to be caused by prior exposure to chemotherapy drugs. Other cancers could be related to that, but not hepatocellular carcinoma in particular. It's more related to hepatitis and alcohol and fatty liver, chronic liver injury that would eventually lead to scarring tissue in the liver, what we call cirrhosis, and then eventually hepatocellular carcinoma.
And then we have a question from one of our participants. How should I prepare for a surgery to remove the tumors on my liver? Dr. Ryan, can you address that question?
Well, it's important to be as active as you possibly can going up and up until the time of surgery. Make sure that you review your medication list with the surgeons or the nurse practitioners in the surgical clinic. It's very important to make sure that you're not on any medications that the surgeon doesn't want you to be on. And then I would say keep a positive attitude. You know, everything's going to be okay. These folks do this procedure all the time, and you'll be okay.
Excellent. And another from one of our online participants, I was recently diagnosed with liver cancer and need a liver transplant. What can I do to help myself while on the liver transplant waiting list? Dr. Kassab, can you address that?
Yeah, so first of all is to get evaluated by a medical oncologist and also get a referral to the liver transplant team, because it really makes a huge difference to ask this question upfront and get clear answers. Some patients who are not candidates upfront to liver transplant could be down the line when their tumor gets smaller in size and so on. But it's not only about the tumor size, it's about the patient's overall health condition and so on. So the question really has to be asked upfront, because it's a very vigorous process to evaluate the patient's heart and lung condition and all of that. So I would say check with your medical oncologist and get a referral to a liver transplant team.
Excellent. We have another question, actually, about how can I find support groups near where I live. I'm going to ask Ms. Ezra if you would address that question in a general way.
Well, if you wanted a face-to-face support group, what I do is I go on the American Cancer Society's website, and they do have a place where you can find some local resources. And then you look under support groups, and it'll give you a listing of all of the support groups that are in a, I don't know what the mileage is, maybe it's 25 miles in around the zip code that you place in there. I also just tell people to talk to their hospital social worker, because there may be some at the treatment center where they're going, and they can join those. You know, I mean, some of those groups are once a month or every other month, but I think that they can have tremendous benefits for people. There are wellness communities in some areas. They also have support groups, so that's something that you could find out through, I would say, somebody at the hospital, because I'm sure they would know if there's a wellness community in that area.
And can you comment on just telephone groups and online groups, as though they're not in their exact community, but they actually are a phone call or a computer away from them?
Right. I was just going to say, you could always call us, and we could, if you can't find something locally, if we can't help you find something locally, we could always help you get into one of our telephone groups or show you how to register for one of the online groups. And I run both a online group and a telephone group, and I think that the people on both of those mediums get a lot of support. They get a lot of questions answered, and they don't feel as isolated. They feel really connected to each other, and so, you know, it's not the same as face-to-face, but I think it can be just as beneficial.
Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. What diet should I have before and after surgery? Ms. Burden, can you address that?
Absolutely. In general, if you don't have any striking health conditions that your physician and medical team are treating, we encourage a well-balanced diet. You want to make sure that you have enough protein in your diet, that you're getting the calories that you need to maintain your weight, or whatever instructions your medical team's provided you. Sometimes they'll encourage you to gain some weight. It all just depends on your situation. But definitely, eating a variety of foods in your diet as they're allowed, meeting with your dietitian to be more specific for the needs that you are experiencing is important. Sometimes there may be a need to have a higher amount of a specific nutrient in your diet. And when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about protein or calories, et cetera. And so definitely just maintaining your activity, like was mentioned earlier, and eating a healthy, balanced diet.
Thank you. And we have a question from another of our online participants. How often should a person with cirrhosis get screened for liver cancer? Dr. Ryan, could you address that question?
Yeah, interesting. So often people recommend annual ultrasounds for folks with cirrhosis, but I would follow up with the local gastroenterologist who sees you. This is an area that's evolving and depends upon the underlying etiology of the cirrhosis. So anybody with cirrhosis should be followed actively by a hepatologist and follow those recommendations for screening of their liver for liver cancer.
Awesome. Thank you. And another question about the Affordable Care Act for Ms. Wolf. Are there any new laws within the Affordable Care Act that will help people living with cancer financially? Ms. Wolf, can you address that in a general way? We've done a whole program on that, I realize. But
I mean, there's, in terms of the fact that, for example, there's the Medicaid expansion, so there'll be more access to Medicaid for people that might be lower income. The standards will be raised. And in terms of claim coverages in general, there'll be more, I think, more types of claims will be covered. So I think in general, there's no specific laws within the Affordable Care Act, but certainly the intent of the Act is to make sure not only that everybody is insured, but that their claims are covered, and of course, expanded rights to appeal as well. So I think the effect of the Act will be that insurance companies will, more people will be insured, and insurance companies will cover more claims.
And could you comment on just screening and just the pre-existing conditions as well?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of good things that are coming from the Act. One of them is that a lot of the people that I work with have already benefited from is that there's no longer any caps on coverage, so that insurance companies can't limit the dollar amount and have to pay for all claims. And also for people that have been uninsured and need insurance, there no longer will be, for most plans, with a few exceptions, any exclusions for pre-existing conditions, so that even people that have a cancer diagnosis or other pre-existing conditions will be able to obtain coverage.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been, it's quite the tour de force today, a really extraordinary group. I want to thank you all for your wonderful presentations. I want to thank all of you who've asked questions, mostly online, actually. A lot of our online participants have a number of really good questions that really helped to expand the call today. And thank you for your questions. And thank you all who've been listening to the call today. So if you do have a question that you didn't get to ask, please contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. We have a staff of over 35 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to help you. We help you with practical and financial issues, with counseling and support groups. We have many of these type of workshops on different topics. We also have a number of different fact sheets and publications for you, and a very robust and active website as well. Also, I just want to reiterate the number that Elizabeth Ezra had given all of you before in terms of the Chronic Disease Fund for any of you who are seeking financial help with specific liver cancer copay help. That number is 877-968-7233. And you will all be getting information about the resources mentioned during today's call when we send you a follow-up. We're going to send you a follow-up to today's program, and you'll be getting that information and the other resources that were mentioned as well. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with liver cancer, in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're really here to help you. And we are simply a phone call away, and you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.